18. The Indoor Circuit. St. James, Long Island, Fall 1958. It was back to the routine at the Knox School, and even though the giddy summer had passed in a flash and the big gray horse had returned to Champion, there was no sign that Mrs. Finney and Miss Wood were impressed. Education was a serious business, and whatever horse show frippery Harry may have indulged in on his off time was of little interest to them. If they had seen the pictures or read the headlines, they gave no sign. Snowman returned to his stall in the semicircular stable and seemed perfectly content to carry the girls in their lessons. The days continued balmy and sunny through the first few weeks of September, and Harry enjoyed his teaching schedule, even though the girls also gave no notice of Snowman's summer triumphs. They had all gone off to their vacation activities and had most likely given no thought to their school horses and where they had been. Harry put Snowman right back into the lesson lineup. The horse needed to earn his keep, and the Knox ladies had always approved of him because he was quiet and never gave the children any trouble. More than once, a girl had come back from the barn, smiling and thrilled by some new accomplishment, a girl who had never trotted or cantered before, a girl who had been too timid to jump. Snowman's manner was so unassuming, and Harry was so encouraging that the girls always felt that the triumph was all their own. At night, at home with Johanna, Harry plotted out the fall. There were a few more local weekend shows he could go to, but the rest of the season looked hopeless. The horses in contention for the big year-end prizes would spend the fall campaigning, from the Pennsylvania National at Harrisburg down to Washington, D.C., where a brand new international show was promising to make a big splash. Then it was on to Madison Square Garden. Horses would be racking up points faster than ever at these week-long shows. In a single show, a horse that did well could match the points earned over the entire summer season. Harry looked bleakly at the calendar. A day to drive to Harrisburg, another day to drive back, and 7 days of show. The same for Washington. He and Johanna talked it over. Snowman and Harry had already qualified for the Garden. If only one or two of his students could qualify for the junior division, then the Knox headmistresses would have to let them go. But the Pennsylvania National and the Washington International were out of the question. Even if Harry and Snowman won every class they entered, he could not earn enough prize money to support the horses and his family. He needed his job at Knox. That was an incontrovertible fact of his life, and the truth was, he was grateful to have the job, grateful that the swank school had taken a chance on someone like him, an immigrant who was just learning English and who had no social connections. Maybe somebody else in his position would have felt thwarted. Here he was on the cusp of an unthinkable triumph, and he had to fold his hand. But Harry was a teacher. He stood in the sun in the middle of the arena on hot days. He stood in the courtyard getting wet when it rained, day in, day out. Harry was there with his students, watching them, analyzing their riding styles, and sharing his wisdom. And Snowman was a teacher, too. Fat girls and timid girls, shy girls and stiff girls, any girl, whoever needed him, climbed aboard the big gray teddy bear and grew braver. "Grab the mane!" Harry hollered, "because that's what the good Lord put it there for." One after another, the girls grabbed Snowy's thick white mane to anchor them over the fences. One after another, the girls gained confidence, fell in love with the horse, and brought him extra carrots and apples tucked into their pockets. Harry was proud of his girls. He loved to hold them to high standards and to ask them to do things that they did not know they could accomplish until they were done. The girls gave a little extra for their young instructor because they sensed that he believed in them, sometimes more than they believed in themselves. Back at the Delayer house, Johanna had started a scrapbook with clippings of Snowman's exploits, and they had placed the trophies and hung ribbons all around the tidy living room. At Knox, in the rain and the sun, Harry put away the glorious quest of summer and focused on the present, just as he had always done. He planned a schedule of local shows and thought about his stellar pupils, the ones who might be able to ride at the Garden. Sure, in the mornings, up early, working alongside Jim Troutwell, cleaning stalls, he thought about that PHA championship. When was the last time a horse in the lead for the trophy had dropped out of the competition? Probably never. Luckily, Harry had no time to dwell on that question. There were back-to-back junior shows for the next 2 weekends, and Snowman came along, carrying his students around the courses. Harry let Bonnie ride Snowman in the junior jumpers, and she got a little cocky, thinking he was a piece of cake to ride. Instead, he fooled her, ducking out from the side of a fence rather than jumping. From the sidelines, Harry had to chuckle at his four-legged teacher. Now 16, Bonnie was one of his most gifted students, one he could trust with the green and challenging horses. She had taken old Teddy Bear for granted, and he had been too smart for her. Harry saw the tears of humiliation brimming in her eyes when she rode out of the ring, but he knew she had learned a lesson, albeit a hard one. Don't ever take a horse for granted, especially not a horse like Snowman. He would treat the smallest child gently, but the horse also seemed to sense when a rider could use a challenge. Harry knew that Bonnie would be working harder than ever in the days to come, and that she would learn from her lesson. Back at the barn, as she untacked him and settled him in for the night, Harry felt for the girl, but said nothing. She would persevere and go on to win on other days. Harry could see that Snowman was happy, and he suffered no ill effects from carrying the lesson girls around on his back and taking them through their classes at the junior shows. But each day, when Harry headed out to the stable, he thought about the summer's triumphs and of Snowman's performance against the toast of Europe. It felt wrong. The horse had been put on a shelf before he'd had a chance to show the world what he could do. Sure, he was 100 times better off now than he'd been as a plow horse, but he was using only a small part of his talent carrying the lesson girls around the stable. Harry remembered showing the gold Blitz trophy to the horse and what it felt like to parade him around that swank arena at Piping Rock, knowing that he was second to none. By the end of September, Harry had resolved to do something. Dave Kelly had ridden Snowman to a win at the Smithtown Horse Show, beating his own Andante in the process. Harry knew that there were not many men who would do that, but Dave was not an ordinary man. Dave was beloved on the horse show circuit, a true sportsman, a talented rider, and a straight shooter, a man to be trusted. That weekend, at the Huntington Junior Show, Harry proposed a plan. Snowman deserved a chance to see what he could do. Harry would stay home and tend to his duties, and Snowman would go with Dave to the Washington International Horse Show, the last big contest before the Garden. October 10th through 15th, 1958, was just another ordinary week at the Knox School, but the barn seemed empty with Snowman gone. Dave Kelly had loaded the horse into the van and taken him to Washington, D.C. The delayers would have to follow the show's progress the same way everyone else did, in the newspapers. The Washington International Horse Show was an upstart on the horse show scene, and its founding that year showed how important horse showing had become to the social hierarchy. New York was the traditional center of the East Coast establishment, but with the Cold War in full swing, Washington was rising in importance, with the growing government bureaucracy centered around the nation's capital. The late 1950s was the era of the unbeatable New York Yankees, but in October 1958, Damn Yankees, about a Washingtonian who sold his soul to the devil in order to help the Washington Senators beat the Yankees, opened in movie theaters, perhaps reflecting the national capital's desire to rival New York in other areas. That same month, the Washington International Horse Show made its first appearance on the national stage. Hosting a great horse show was starting to be an important aspect of a city's civic pride. The show opened on October 10th at the spacious and well-appointed National Guard Armory. 2 international teams, Germany and Mexico, were on the program. While the United States equestrian team was not officially represented, 3 members of the team, Sandra Phipps, Frank Shappett, and Jeb Wofford, were competing for the United States. The Germans had brought a powerhouse lineup that included the 1958 European champion and Diamant's former rider, Fritz Tiedemann, and Hans-Gunter Winkler, the 1956 Olympic gold medalist. As usual, the international division was reserved for members of the amateur equestrian teams. Dave would be competing in the open jumper division with Snowman. The Washington International ran like clockwork, from the skilled precision of the jump crew to the cleanliness of the stabling and grounds. The city put on a tip-top performance, as though to challenge the old guard of New York. The stands were full every day. But people hoping to see the Americans triumph instead saw the Germans hammer the Americans in every international class. The U.S. team members put in a collection of hair-raising rounds, complete with knocked-down fences, crashes, and falls. By the last night of the show, the team had managed to collect only two ribbons, a third and a fourth. Then, during the evening performance, Frank Shappett, riding one of Elio Sears's horses, crashed spectacularly on the final fence, a fall so devastating that the crowd paused in horror, unsure whether anyone would walk away. Fortunately, neither horse nor rider was seriously hurt. In the open jumper classes, Snowman and the newcomer Windsor Castle battled it out. Snowman won the first class, but lost to Windsor Castle in the second, and Windsor Castle was in the lead for the show championship. Dave called Harry to give him the news. Snowman needed to win the stakes class, or he would no longer be in the lead for the American Horse Show's Association Horse of the Year award. Windsor Castle had been campaigning since the spring, winning big at Devon and in Virginia. People were saying the seven-year-old was the most promising new horse on the circuit. A high-strung, half-thoroughbred, he looked more talented than Snowman. By a lot. Back in St. James, Harry waited for Dave's nightly telephone call with his reports of the German triumphs and the United States' dismal failures and of the fierce competition from Windsor Castle. Harry was grateful to Dave, and yet he could not help feeling that maybe if he were there, the horse's familiar rider. But there was no use thinking about that. He had responsibilities that came before winning blue ribbons. Windsor Castle was tough competition, and Dave was not making any promises. On October 15th, the show's last night, the giant gates of the armory show ring swung open. It was time for the Parade of Nations. The U.S. Army Marching Band played The Caissons Go Rolling Along, and President Dwight D. Eisenhower sat, with Mamie beside him, up in the presidential box. First into the ring was the German team, carrying the German flag. The four horsemen, who together had taken every single championship ribbon in the international competition, stopped under the glowing spotlights and saluted. Next in line was the Mexican team, whose mounts, according to the Washington Post, looked like rodeo ponies next to the big German horses. Perhaps, but they had still managed to collect more ribbons than the Americans. It probably did not escape a military man like General Eisenhower that Frank Shappett sat upon Trail Guide, one of the greatest horses ever to compete for the United States equestrian team. The last American horse still competing to have served in the United States cavalry, Trail Guide had been bred in the Army's remount program, the ambitious breeding program that had produced so many great horses, possibly including Snowman's sire. Trail Guide, the last remaining link to the great military jumping tradition, was the only horse that actually belonged to the United States equestrian team. That night in front of the president, Frank Shappett, perhaps still sore from his horrible crash of the night before, rode Trail Guide to a triumph in the jump-off over Fritz Tiedemann of Germany, the only win of the show for the American team. Last up on the agenda was the crowd-pleasing favorite, the Open Jumper Championship. Dave Kelly rode the big gray gelding out under the spotlights of the armory, then stopped to salute the president. The crowd was already keyed up from Trail Guide's victory. The international competitions were thrilling, and seeing the Stars and Stripes win was always exciting. But when Snowman, the underdog favorite, entered the ring, the crowd let out a cheer. Snowman represented every little guy, everyone not sitting in a VIP seat, every worker at the armory that night, pushing a wheelbarrow or a broom, and everybody who was not born into the kind of privilege that competed in the ring that night. For the American people, the competition was about more than just the horses. After all, America was in the midst of several other competitions—capitalism versus communism, the space race, Dave knew this horse needed to win this class, and he wanted to have good news when he called Delayer at home. The pressure was intense. There was so much to distract a horse here in the armory. The army marching band, the thousands of spectators, the ring steward clad in a bright red waistcoat who sounded out the beginning of each class on his long brass horn known as the Yard of Tin. The spotlights made a stippled pattern of golden streaks interspersed with patches of darkness. Not an easy place to ride a jumper horse. But Dave had a job to do, and Snowman seemed to sense it. As the honest gelding soared brilliantly over each fence under the gleaming spotlights, he captivated the crowd. Like trail guide, Snowman's dignity had nothing to do with class or breeding, and everything to do with heart. None of the other horses, not Windsor Castle, not First Chance, could match the gray horse's performance that night. In the last class of the night, with the President of the United States of America in attendance, Snowman brought home the championship. Snowman was now assured of the leading spot for Horse of the Year going into the National. The rest of the horses on the circuit would go straight from Washington up to Harrisburg for another week of chances at the Pennsylvania National. Only Snowman would miss the show, returning home to the Delayers and the lessons at Knox. The culminating event of the last night of the show was the parade of champions. Into the ring came the show's top performers. The best ponies and roadsters, hunters and jumpers, paraded around the ring and in front of the presidential box. The horses lined up in order, each gleaming blue-blooded champion seemingly more beautiful than the last. Snowman, the ex-plow horse, was the final horse to enter. He walked around the ring, head low, pace relaxed, not spooking at the flashing lights or loud music or cheers of the crowds, but turning to look at the stands as though to acknowledge his fans. He might have been mistaken for a fish out of water, a rube who had stumbled by accident into a high society party, were it not for the tricolor that hung from his bridle, marking him as a champion. Dave was not the showman Harry was, but he waved to the crowd as they paraded by, a crowd whose applause turned to cheers as the announcer referred to Snowman as the $80 Wonder Horse. When Dave Kelly called St. James long distance that night, the Delayer clan, clustered near the phone waiting for news, let out whoops of delight. Winner of the stakes and reserve champion of the show at the Washington International? If only they had been able to go along, no doubt he would have been champion. Johanna quieted the children and got them tucked into bed, but Harry was too elated to sleep. He remembered the honor of parading in front of the Queen of Holland as the country celebrated her return from exile in London. Now his horse had paraded in front of the president of his new country. He regretted only that he had not been in the armory to share that moment with his big gray companion. That night, Harry vowed to himself that someday he himself would ride for the president on Snowman. 19. The Diamond Jubilee. New York City, November 1958. In Manhattan, you could always tell when it was time for the National Horse Show. In the first week of November, the New Yorker sported a horse show-themed cover. Maids bustled along Fifth Avenue opening townhomes as society people closed up their Long Island estates to spend the winter in town. The Herald Tribune devoted half-page spreads to photographs of men in black tie and women wearing evening gowns. Newspaper society columns carried daily talk of the parties, relating who was going where, with whom, in exhaustive laundry lists of families. Knickerbocker, Whitney, Vanderbilt, Morgan, whose names read like American royalty. But this year, the excitement was ratcheted up an extra notch. For this was no ordinary year at the National Horse Show. This was the 75th year, the Diamond Jubilee. The show, which had started as a way for the upper crust to display their fine carriage horses, had improbably survived and thrived into the automobile era. The National truly was a national event. Competitors came from near and far. the finest roadsters, high-stepping horses who pulled light carriages, hailed from the Midwest. The saddlebreds and walking horses came from the South, and the top riders from the West Coast made the pilgrimage every year. Air travel for horses was rare and mostly reserved for transatlantic trips. Most people vanned their horses to New York, even making the week-long drive from California, though Mrs. Luella Combs, the perpetual champion in the roadster divisions, brought her fine hackneys from St. Louis via private train coach. Everyone in the horse world whom Harry knew would be there. Mickey Walsh and Captain Littauer, even Colonel John Russell, whom he'd met for the first time in Amsterdam. So would all of the professionals he admired and who had mentored him, Dave Kelly, Cappy Smith, and Joe Green, as well as his toughest competitors, Adolf Mogavero and Alfiore. The show lasted 8 days, always opening on Election Day, a Tuesday. Classes ran all day and evening, with so many entries that competitors were winnowed down in the morning qualifying rounds. Only the top horses would be selected to perform in the nighttime events. After a grueling summer and fall of trailering and debarking, settling into unfamiliar makeshift stables, competing in different arenas and over varying terrain, now it was time for the horse show that would task the strength and endurance of the best of them. This was more than a test of skill or breeding, though both were important. In this contest, the 8-day trial would become a test of spirit, of the quality horsemen call bottom, and that spectators instinctively recognize as heart. Some of the big barns, including Ox Ridge and Duffy Stables, came with 20 or more horses and a small army of grooms, but there were always a few riders who came with just one horse. Jimmy Wybe, the saddlemaker, had brought his horse, the Stitcher. James Crawford of Kingswood, Missouri, wanted to be there so badly that he had put every penny into the entry fee, not leaving enough money for a hotel room. He planned to bed down in the stall next to his horse. Anyone who considered himself a horseman and could find some way to get there was there. To the press and the public, it was the National. To horsemen, it was called the Garden. As Esther R. Boots Barker said in a history of the National Horse Show, "This was the world where a single rub will knock you out of the ribbons, and a marginally missed distance would send you back to the barn. Any ribbon from the Garden was worth its weight in blood, sweat, and tears." Some horsemen even referred to it as the start of the horseman's new year. It was the crowning event of every rider's calendar. Harry had 2 students competing on their own horses in the junior classes, and he had brought along the flighty mare, Night Arrest. Representing Mr. and Mrs. Harry DeLayer, there was just one horse, Snowman. Harry was itching to get back into the ring on him. He had been forced to sit at home, getting news from the shows at Washington and Harrisburg only second hand. But those shows were over. What mattered now was that Harry and Snowman were registered entrants in the National Horse Show. The National had its own magic. Every horseman believed it. Unexpected things happen. Favorites faded. New champions were born in one thundering round under the spotlights. The Garden. Harry remembered the year before, his improbable 4th-place ribbon with St. John, and the pain of leaving the horse behind. Ah, no use in thinking about that. Coming into the show, everyone thought First Chance would be the horse to beat. No one was thinking about Snowman, who had sat out the Pennsylvania National, the second biggest show of the year. Harry aimed to prove everyone wrong, but it wouldn't be easy. On the morning of November 2nd, 1958, Harry awoke at 3 a.m. after having barely slept. He had been out at the barn late getting the horses ready, and now he had to prepare for the trip to Manhattan. Long before dawn, he tossed fresh hay into Snowman's feeder, straightened his blanket, and gathered up the thick cotton batting and rolls of wool flannel that he used to bandage the horse's legs to protect them from injury in the horse trailer. The ride into the city, with its jarring potholes, tight turns and starts and stops, would be harder on a horse than the usual journeys over country roads. Snowy stood still while Harry crouched beside him, the stall illuminated only by the single bulb that hung under the eaves. It was cold, and Harry's fingers were stiff but deft, having done these preparations hundreds of times before. The horse must have known the routine by now, must have sensed that something was going on by the bustle of preparation in the pre-dawn light. But he stood patiently as always, munching on hay while Harry bandaged him. The barn was quiet except for the rustling of the horses in the other stalls and the sound of Harry's dog sniffing around outside. As he contemplated his handiwork on the bandages, straightening them up and inserting a finger under the batting to make sure they were just the right tightness, not snug enough to cut off circulation, not loose enough to fall off, Harry knew that some competitions were lost in the trailer on the way to the show from a lack of care in preparation. He probably had a little edge on his competitors. Other owners were snug in their beds now, maybe sleeping off hangovers from the last round of parties, and they would never know if a slipshod groom didn't get the bandages quite right. Their horse could come up lame, and the owner would have no idea why. Harry looked at his hands, deeply calloused and already gnarled like an old man's from a couple of broken fingers. These same hands had grabbed hold of Snowy's mane when it was long and tangled and ratted. These hands had doctored the gray's wounds and carried hay for him and measured grain. These hands had groomed the horse and saddled him, rubbed liniment into his legs, and iced him through the night when he got hurt. Jumping a horse was more than stepping into expensive riding clothes. For Harry, competing at the garden was more than sitting in a fancy tack room fitted out like a gentleman's club and waiting for the groom to bring the horse around. Each time he set out to ride in a show, he reminded himself that he knew this horse as well as he knew his own children. He had tended to him in sickness and in health, like he did his own family. He had ridden the horse in shows, but also down to the beach and over the hunting fields, and he had watched him carry girls and the children. Other owners did not do that. Other riders had helpers do the dirty work for them, but Harry did not wish that life for himself. That deep down understanding, that bond between him and his horse, was about much more than winning ribbons. Harry believed that it was his secret weapon. Harry looked Snowy over once more, satisfied that the horse was ready. He scratched the horse's withers and was rewarded with Snowy's trademark smile. The horse looked him in the eye, and Harry felt that current pass between them, his teddy bear, his friend. Come what may, they would give it their best shot. They were a team. Harry grasped the lead rope with his calloused hands, and the horse followed willingly. Nobody could predict what challenges lay in store, but one thing Harry knew for sure. This horse had bottom. It was still dark as Harry pulled onto Moritz's road, and the surrounding farms were quiet. The children were still asleep. They would come later with Johanna to watch. The trip to the city took several hours. The country roads in Suffolk County turned into highways in Nassau County, and then the skyline rose up in front of them as he and Jim Troutwell drove the big rig toward the Queen's Midtown Tunnel. 2 hours after leaving the peaceful hamlet of St. James, Harry drove the horse van across 34th Street and up 8th Avenue, the skyscrapers of Manhattan towering around them. Car horns honked and yellow taxis sped by, cutting in and out of traffic. They had entered a whole new world. Among the stodgy denizens of the National Horse Show Committee, there were those who claimed that the show had reached its apogee in the year 1898, the height of the Gilded Age, the same era that had produced the mansions and way of life that surrounded Harry's home on Long Island. Every year thereafter, some old codger was sure to lament that the National was not quite the show that she used to be, the implication being that someone had let the riffraff in. Until 1925, the show had been held in a Beaux-Arts palace at 26th Street and Madison Avenue in Manhattan, now referred to as Madison Square Garden II. The elaborate building, designed by McKim, Mead, and White and considered a marvel of its time, contained a summer garden, an arena for the horses, and an indoor restaurant. A bronze statue of Diana soared from the rooftop. Inside, Blue Bloods, both horses and people, pranced. Around the arena swooped a flower-banked 20-foot-wide promenade where top-hatted gentlemen escorted evening-gowned ladies, while young boys tried to make a buck pointing out celebrities to out-of-town visitors. Garden, too, like many large Victorian structures, had not been built to last. It succumbed to the Wrecker's Ball in 1927, but the Committee to Preserve the Horse Show quickly grabbed a toehold in a new venue. In 1928, the horse show moved to a building that inspired both devotion and loathing. Built in 1925 and known as the House That Tex Built, after Tex Rickard, a boxing promoter and the owner of the New York Rangers, the third building, known as Madison Square Garden, was not on Madison Square, but on 49th Street between 7th and 8th Avenues. From the outside, Madison Square Garden squatted angularly, a water tower awkwardly poised on the roof. The design did not naturally suit itself to an equine affair, and there were always a few old-timers who complained. But by 1958, during this distinctive week, the building itself seemed wrapped in a special mystique. As the horse trailers pulled up along 7th Avenue, an unmistakable aura of grandeur buzzed in the air. For all of the glory upstairs in the garden, the basement was a sorry excuse for a stabling area. The ventilation was famously poor, and made worse by people who ignored the no-smoking rule. Horses were prone to respiratory infections, which spread like wildfire in the enclosed space. Grooms from the Mexican team cooked in their stalls, filling the aisles with the odor of sizzling tortillas. In order to allow a horse to stretch his legs, you had to walk him up on the street. But as hot and stuffy as it was in the basement, the air outside in the streets of Manhattan was cold, and the contrast could stiffen muscles and make a horse's cold grow worse. Harry was stabled in a corner, in a few box stalls that were off the beaten path. Like everything at the garden, there was a hierarchy. The best stabling, the best boxes, the best parties, the best order to ride in the competitions were all distributed with an eye to social standing and status. The upstairs-downstairs mentality, still so prevalent among the East Coast upper class, was much in force at the garden. Despite the egalitarian notions that were supposed to characterize a democratic society, the American horseman had, from the get-go, in the words of Kurth Sprague, who wrote the definitive history of the National Horse Show, patterned himself on an Anglo-Saxon model whose exemplar was the upper-class English country gentleman. Even in the late 1950s, at the National, this mentality still prevailed. American society was in the midst of important changes. It was becoming clear that the grand estates, like Elio Sears's Pride's Crossing and Rock Edge, were relics of another age. There was a series of articles in the New York Times in 1957 about how society in four American cities, New York, Philadelphia, Boston, and Washington, was starting to modernize. Social institutions that the horsey set had taken for granted were evolving as new people with new money increasingly had more power and influence. Many of the great old money families had fortunes so large that they had been relatively unaffected by the financial turmoils of the 1930s. But as the 1950s drew to a close, there was a new focus on merit and equal opportunity. Yet here, at the National Horse Show, the world remained comfortably and familiarly stratified. The working folk sat up in the bleachers. The fine folk came and went in chauffeured Bentleys and clustered in the boxes along the promenade. Down in the basement, an army of grooms, mostly African-American, tended to the horses. In those days, Sprague notes, every decent stable had a tack man, whose only job was to polish the leather and brass, and stable workers for the Mexican team, tasked with keeping the horses spotless, did not use a pitchfork to clean the stables, but did it by hand. A series of photographs in Life magazine painted the scene downstairs. A man clad in custom-made riding clothes sits on a canvas director's chair in a tack room that has been gussied up to look like the drawing room of a country manor. In the next pictures, an African-American groom fusses over the horse, removing the neat bandage from the dapple gray's braided tail, picking his hooves, and tucking the rider's white gloves up under the saddle billets, Meanwhile, the rider, seated in the spotless tack room, pulls on his boots. In the final picture, the rider, astride his immaculate horse, parades across the arena wearing a silk top hat, his expression one of hauteur. The groom will stay behind downstairs, waiting until the rider returns. After handing over the reins, the rider will head out for a night on the town. This was the life at the National Horse Show. Sometimes the owners made their way down the steep ramp to the stabling area, wanting to show off their mounts to their important guests. The grooms stayed downstairs, lovingly tending to the horses, carrying water, cleaning stalls, polishing boots and tack, and often sleeping in the stalls alongside a skittish horse that needed a companion. Ring stewards dressed in red waistcoats and gray top hats bowed to the winners with a precise degree of shading that indicated the social standing of the competitor. Down in one of the tunnels was the Turf and Tack Club, where competitors and show committee members gathered for cocktails. After the show each night, a never-ending circle of dinner parties followed. Out the back door, on 50th Street, the Belvedere Hotel was rumored to be the site of frequent illicit assignations. Until the early 1950s, the exhibitors stayed at the Waldorf Astoria, but by the late 1950s the hotel of choice was the Astor, along the strip of Broadway known as the Great White Way. The Astor, with its elaborate roof gardens and grand anterooms, filled an entire block on the west side of Broadway between 44th and 45th Streets. It was constructed of red brick and limestone with a green slate mansard roof. Designed as a successor to the Waldorf Astoria, the hotel had been built in 1905, another edifice of the Gilded Age. Akin to the rest of the world, so deeply admired by the horse show crowd, the Astor was the epitome of an age that was soon to end. Nobody was thinking about change, but change, nonetheless, was coming. You saw it in the exuberance of the ticket-holding crowds who thronged through the doors, drawn in by a love for horses, by the spectacle of beauty and youth, and by the drumbeat of danger that thrummed in the background as horses whirled around the jumper courses. The crowd was eager for spectacle and for excitement, and nowhere was the thrill more palpable than in the open jumper classes, where horses and riders battled for their victories at breakneck speed, 7 feet above the ground. Down in his part of the stabling area, Harry was settling in his horse, coveralls on, working alongside Jim and Joe. Harry's compact frame looked tiny in comparison. The owners walking by would have no doubt mistaken him for one of the hired hands. From the way he interacted with Jim and Joe, it was clear that they were friends and equals. Johanna and Harriet had pinned up all of Snowman's ribbons next to his stall. An impressive display. People were curious about the gray gelding. His story had been splashed all over the papers in the last few days, and the World Telegram and Sun had run a cartoon drawn by the famous sports cartoonist Willard Mullen. Mullen was best known for creating a character known as the Brooklyn Bum, an everyman Brooklyn Dodgers fan. The Brooklyn Dodgers were gone, but Mullen still had a fondness for underdogs. Mullen's cartoon recounted, in graphic form, the story of Snowman's rescue from the slaughterhouse, both his and Harry's humble origins, and his triumph over the past few months leading to the National. For New Yorkers riding the subway and reading the paper folded to the sports page, Snowman was a favorite to watch. Spectators came by to get a peek at the horse, admiring the ribbons and the friendly manner with which Snowman greeted everyone. He never seemed to mind a pat on the nose from the array of passing children, and Harry did not mind either. The whole family smiled and said hello, and the horse seemed to bask in the attention. Hot-headed night arrest was a different story. She had been skittish and unpredictable just being unloaded from the trailer, not reacting well to the unfamiliar sooty city air and clanging sounds of Seventh Avenue. She was restless in her stall, even with Snowy's calming presence next door. When Harry took her out for exercise in the cramped warm-up area, he had his hands full. He had no idea how she would react to the spectacle upstairs, but this was not a good sign. People spent hours, days, and years training for this show, spending huge sums of money. Owners like Elio Sears could afford to pamper their horses, and those who worked with her said that they had only to mention wanting something for the horses, a feed supplement, grooming tool, or a special piece of tack, and soon it would arrive by the carton full, no matter the cost. A win at the garden represented one of the few things that the rich folk could not buy outright. Every aspect of the week at the National was a competition, a contest over the best help, the finest tack, the best organized stables, the newest chic trainer everyone wanted, the best invitations, and the most gossiped-about affaire d'amour. The National brought many opportunities for social triumphs, but none equaled the sheer delight of a blue ribbon won fair and square in the horse show ring, a thrill money could not buy. The children had made a sign, and Harry tacked it on Snowman's stall door with pride. Compared to the big stables, Hollandia was a simple mom-and-pop shop, a place where wooden shoes lined up in the corner and the owner was a jack-of-all-trades, handling a jumper course or a pitchfork with equal aplomb. He did nothing to try to impress people. He cared about only one test, the one that started upstairs in the ring, the only one that mattered. The opening ceremonies started at 11 o'clock sharp on Tuesday, November 4th, and Johanna arrived with the children with plenty of time to spare. The entrance to the garden was flanked by Cosby's Sporting Goods on one side and Needick's Cafeteria on the other. At Needick's, customers sat at the counter on whirl-around stools, sipping the chain's famous sticky-sweet orange drink and eating hot dogs or grilled cheese sandwiches. Over the garden's entrance hung a vast theater-style marquee, lettered with its famous abbreviation, Madison SQ Garden. This year, the marquee blazed with an additional abbreviated announcement, DIMNDJBLEE. All around was the din and blare of Midtown Manhattan, unlike anything the Delayer children had ever seen. Through the doors into the grand lobby, one entered another world. People milled around wearing outfits more befitting a society ball than a venue best known for hosting prize fights and the Barnum and Bailey Circus. Beautiful people disembarked from chauffeured Rolls-Royces wearing, as Kurt Sprague noted, Melton and Mink, top hats and tweeds, long evening dresses from C.L. Chapman, and chic long riding coats and flared breeches from Hertz or Nardi, Cordovan's stuffed hunting boots and black patent leather evening pumps, and white tie and wide-wailed corduroy. The press was always out in full force, society and fashion magazines jostling elbows with an assortment of sports columnists come to cover the show for one of New York's dozen daily newspapers. The first tier of seats were the ringside boxes, so coveted and closely held that acquiring access to one was a social triumph. Behind the boxes, the seats rose up in three sharp tiers, jamming the maximum seating space into an area only 200 feet wide. At the time, the garden was the largest covered venue in the world, able to accommodate more than 20,000 spectators. Through the turnstile, manned by ticket collectors in tuxedos, ticket bearers wearing their Sunday best rubbed shoulders with the box holders in their evening finery. Around the promenade, hot dog vendors, program salesmen, and souvenir vendors tried to catch the attention of the ordinary folk who passed by the ringside boxes to reach the cheap seats, known as heaven, up under the eaves. A thick canopy of cigarette smoke always hung in a blue cloud just below the covered rooftop. Families clutching programs purchased for an expensive $1.50 sat high up above the ring with a good view of the spectacle, both horse and human. Inside the pages of the program were pictures of the trophies to be won, and lists of members of the international teams as well as of all the classes and participants. The air pulsed with an intoxicating mix of danger and allure, pageantry and sophistication. In addition to the competitions, the program was packed with exhibitions. The Royal Canadian Mounted Police, the Budweiser Clydesdales, displays of rodeo tricks and roping, a dressage demonstration by television personality Arthur Godfrey, and the glitz and glitter of the Latin American teams, whose gold-braided white military jackets and charging riding styles always spiced up the international events. For a child up in the stands, it was all a wonderland, even for the Delayer children, Chef, now 7, Harriet, 5, Marty, 4, William, 3, and the baby, Harry Jr., 18 months, who had grown used to watching their father perform in the horse show ring. The crowds, the spectacle, and the spotlights of Madison Square Garden made the entire experience seem new. As always, they were dressed up, slicked down, and perfectly behaved under Johanna's watchful eye. But for the next 8 nights, they would be allowed to stay up late in the stands and watch. This was the most exciting week of their lives. Eager to watch the opening ceremonies, crowds packed the stands. Just as in Washington, the U.S. Army Marching Band played a rousing Sousa march for the parade of the international teams. With all of the dazzle of the Diamond Jubilee, the stands were filled to capacity, a bigger crowd than ever, and a more boisterous one, unlike the decorous society crowd that showed up at places like Piping Rock. This was mostly a New York crowd, clapping, stomping, cheering, and catcalling as they saw fit. The international teams paraded in, each stopping in the center of the arena under a ring of spotlights, as the Army marching band played its country's national anthem. Every time he saw the parade of nations, Harry could not help but feel some mixed emotions. Sadness that his native country of Holland was not represented, an underlying sense of dismay at the presence of the German team, and a pride in the team of his adopted homeland, the United States of America, tinged with just a shadow of regret that as a professional he would never be able to carry his adopted homeland's flag into the ring. The Cuban team paraded into the ring to the stirring trumpet blasts of La Bella Mesa, flanked by the blue, red, and white of the Cuban flag. Suddenly the crowd erupted, spewing forth a group of men who stormed down from the stands into the ring, shouting protests against the Cuban team and trying to grab the Cuban flag and disrupt the Army marching band from playing the anthem. In a flash, the arena was filled with the Irish Mafia, the dedicated network of ring stewards and groundskeepers who informally policed the show. A moment later, brass-buttoned, billy club-toting members of the NYPD escorted the rabble-rousers out of the stadium, and the show continued. Some in the crowd hooted and heckled, as though this were one of the prize fights the Garden was famous for hosting. It was unclear whether the noisy spectators were supporting the hecklers or the police who quelled the protest. World politics erupting in as sheltered a venue as the National Horse Show seemed unthinkable, and the frontier crowd seemed embarrassed by the spectacle. The horse show was unaccustomed to being the center of a non-equine matter. Just 7 weeks later, on January 1, 1959, Castro would overthrow the Batista government and set up communist rule in Cuba. But that night, the horse show crowd did not seem to know what to make of the unexpected intrusion of politics from a foreign land. By 1958, it was getting harder and harder to shut the gates around this bastion of privilege. Cracks were appearing in the venerable 75-year-old institution. The people in the stands did not know it then, but the National Horse Show would never again be quite as sheltered from the world at large. The world was pushing at the edges of the horse show, and the audience was opening up to a new breed of fans. As one journalist put it, the crowd seemed to have inherited a lot of Dodger fans. The Brooklyn Dodgers no longer existed. Roy Campanella, their beloved catcher, was in a wheelchair, and the excitement of the Subway Series that had pitted the Yankees against the Dodgers was no more. But nothing said New York like the National Horse Show. In 1958, the spectators seemed different. They were noisy and boisterous, clapping and whooping from the stands. And in 1958... they were in love with an upstart gray horse and his brash, smiling rider. Even in the noise and din of the Diamond Jubilee, there was a little magic. As the program continued, the heckling crowd gradually settled down. After the international parade of teams, the Canadian Mounties, brilliantly clad in red coats and riding all black horses, came in to show off their precision quadrille. Johanna was far too strict to allow her children to join in the general mayhem of the crowd, but they sat quietly on the edges of their seats, drinking in every sight and sound of the thrilling spectacle. Still, they were eager for the jumper contests to begin. In the center of that ring, horses and riders morphed into movie stars and royalty. At ringside in the press box, the lady reporters, Marie LaFrenz and Alice Higgins of Sports Illustrated, jockeyed for space as they rat-a-tatted away on their manual typewriters. The announcer, Otis Trowbridge, was famous for mumbling and mispronouncing riders' names. Spectators had to wait patiently since the order of competitors was not listed in the program, but rather determined by the gatekeeper on an ad hoc basis as each class proceeded. There was an open spot in the arena wall called the Gap, where the trophies were kept, along with a red carpet, a small blue table, and a potted palm. At the close of each class, for the presentation of the trophy, the red carpet was unfurled, the table carried out, and the palm and silver trophy set upon it. The red carpet appeared to honor the horses, but in reality it was there to protect the shoes of the important society ladies, who could not walk through the thick dirt in their dyed-to-match evening pumps. Throughout the show, the silver winked from the shadows of the Gap, the embodiment of promise. The ringmaster, Honey Craven, wore a royal red waistcoat and a gray silk top hat modeled, as tradition dictated, on the costume of the English Royal Guard. Each class was announced by the call of a long brass English hunting horn, his thin, clear piping on the horn, signaling the start of each new class, brought every competitor to full attention. Snowman's first test would be a rematch against Diamant in a fault-and-out class. The combination of timed courses and big spreads always bedeviled the big gray, while Diamant, the German horse, excelled at this kind of class, since in Europe all of them were run this way. Of course, Miss Sears was watching Diamant from her usual private box along the promenade. Her horses had been winning at the garden for decades. Snowman was here on his first improbable trip. Horses and riders milled around, unsure when they would be called. Even the most seasoned competitors looked tense, the horses jigging in place, chomping on their bits. The air vibrated with coiled-up energy waiting to be released. Diamant went early and, true to form, took no notice of the lights or the crowd. He rounded the course with no faults, finishing with a fast time that would be the one to beat. In order to compete, Harry would need to cut the tight corners even tighter. Harry sat astride Snowman, trying to block out the confusion around him. He visualized the course in his mind's eye, imagining each turn, trajectory, and approach. Show jumping resembles sports like diving and ice skating. Years of training, honing skills, and fostering endurance are sandwiched into a few brief, high-risk moments in the spotlight. Every move must be so ingrained, so practiced, so much like breathing that no thought is necessary. Like ice skaters, who sometimes, upon finishing a flawless round, look momentarily surprised, in high-stakes jumper competitions, after years of training, of sacrifice and striving, moments in the ring pass so quickly that the rider and horse barely register what has happened until they are through. Now it was Harry and Snowman's moment. The gate man called out Harry's number. The big gates swung open, revealing the ring, the crowds, the flags, and the huge fences. Harry whispered a word of encouragement and saw Snowy's ear flick back. He patted his neck and urged him forward. The Flying Dutchman and his plow horse were lit up in the glaring center stage lights of Madison Square Garden. Harry sensed his horse's mood, reading the horse's signals through his seat bones, thighs, calves, and hands. Snowman was listening, but with a slight undercurrent of distraction. Harry kept the reins loose, telegraphing trust to his horse. Another pat on the neck, then a cluck. Snowman picked up a canter, and Harry rose up out of the saddle, leaning forward. "Go, boy, go," he whispered. Noise bounced from the walls of the cavernous garden, but Harry saw an ear flick back. The horse was listening. Then all was flying color and spinning motion. The pair flew around the tight turns of the course until they were heading toward the last fence, a big spread. Harry felt the horse's gathering approach, measured the length of his stride, slipped his hands up the crest so that the horse elongated his neck. A striped pattern of light from the spotlights fell across the approach, making the distance hard to judge. On the takeoff, Harry sensed a slight miscue, and sure enough the horse rapped the fence hard with a hind leg. The pole teetered, then fell. The crowd groaned. Looking unperturbed, Harry dropped his reins and leaned over to pat Snowy with both hands. Snowman had failed to beat Diamant's clear round, handing the blue to the German horse. Second place would be decided on time, and when Snowman's time came up on the clock, the crowd erupted in applause. The plow horse had finished the class in second place. In the winner's circle, in the center of the ring, cameras flashed, lighting up the winking silver trophy. Elio Sears accepted it with a gallant air, her weathered, angular face a familiar sight in the ring. When Harry's name was called, he took the red ribbon and waved to the crowd. Second place at the National Horse Show. The Diamond Jubilee was off to a glorious start. Next to Snowman's stall, the children added the silken red ribbon, protesting their certainty that Snowman would win first place in the next class. Nobody could convince them that their horse deserved any less than the blue. The next night was the first of the open jumping classes, where any touch or rub against a fence counted against a horse. Diamant did not compete in touch classes, but the competition would still be tough. The morning elimination round had winnowed down the pack. Only the top contenders would jump in the nighttime round. Every horse that had been chasing points all fall was entered, and every horse that completed a round in the ring tonight had a shot at winning. At the garden, there were no heirs apparent. One false step, one missed turn or misjudged distance could put a champion out of the running. Every year, new heroes were born, and a few seasoned competitors turned into also-rans. Harry was riding both Night Arrest and Snowman tonight. The mare was fidgety and could not seem to get used to the surroundings. Harry took her to the tiny schooling area, wedged between the ramp to the arena gate and the edge of the stalls. Competitors swapped stories about the best way to sharpen a horse within the garden's cramped confines. Trainers set up jumps in the barn aisles, sharing space with grooms primping horses for their moment under the spotlights. The trainer Cappy Smith was said to use the three-stall method, jumping his horses from one stall into the next, making a perfect one stride in and out. Riders looked for opportunities to pole their horses, sometimes arming grooms with broomsticks to wrap the horse's legs on the way up the ramp to the ring, timing these blows to the moment when an ASPCA representative had ducked around a corner. Harry rode Night Arrest around the cramped schooling space, trying to transmit calm to the horse. If she was already this nervous in the schooling area, Harry wondered, how would she react to the grand spectacle in the ring? He did not know how long it would be until his horse was called. The gatekeeper, who worked for Elio Sears in the off-season, was known for playing favorites and being influenced by tips. Like everything else at the National, there was a quasi-invisible pecking order, based on status, position, and wealth. The ramp up to the ring was spread with sawdust and hollow underneath. Wooden slats, like frets on a guitar keyboard, anchored the horse's hooves. More than one horse had been disqualified before ever entering the ring because the rider could not coax the horse up the ramp, and grooms stood at the ready behind in case a horse needed encouragement in the form of a well-timed flick of a whip. Night Arrest jigged up the ramp without prodding, barely contained underneath Harry's steadying hands. Up the gate there was nowhere to circle, just a narrow alleyway. He tried to keep her moving. She was nervous and skittish as a cat. Each time the crowd burst out into raucous applause, she spooked and pranced in place. When the big gate swung open, she shot through it like a stone from a catapult. Harry squeezed the reins and settled his weight deeper in the saddle, but she was not listening well. As he headed toward the first fence, Harry knew he had his work cut out for him. She made it over the initial few fences without mishap, but as she cantered toward the big oxer, a post and rail spread fence, she started to come apart. Right before the jump, she threw in an extra stride, leaving her off-kilter on the takeoff. Before the horse even left the ground, he knew that she would not be able to clear the hurdle. He braced himself. Her front feet flew through the barrier, crashing in a tangle of flying poles. On the landing, she stumbled, about to fall. Harry let his body go soft, preferring to get thrown rather than risk staying with a horse who might tumble on top of him. But in a disastrous turn of events, his foot caught in the stirrup. As the crowd groaned in horror, the Flying Dutchman pounded across the ring, one stride, two, three, dragged by his hooked foot. People watched the disaster in hushed silence. A minute more, and he would be flung against the wooden barrier at the side of the ring, or, worse yet, kicked in the head. But not a split second too soon, Harry managed to wrench himself free. In a flash, he stood up and patted the dirt from his breeches. Nidarest, her sides heaving, stood near the arena wall, trumpeting hot breath through her nose, her eyes still flashing white rims of fear. Harry held out his hand, then slowly walked toward her. She snorted twice, then lowered her head to his outstretched hand. Harry reached up with his other hand and grasped the reins. She did not back away. The crowd clapped as the pair left the ring. Probably only Johanna, up in the stands, could see the way he winced when he walked. Harry rarely showed pain. As if to taunt him, only two horses took their turns before the gate master called out, "Harry DeLayer on Snowman is in the hole." Time to get on the big gray. Putting his bruises out of his mind, Harry stuck a foot through the stirrup and swung up onto Snowman's back, settling his seat bones into the saddle. Snowman walked willingly up the ramp, his reins loose, and stood quietly at the inn-gate. The crowd clapped appreciatively as the pair entered the ring, impressed that the young man was back on another horse so soon. He looked confident enough, even though the crowd had watched him being dragged across the dirt just minutes before. To the spectators, his calm seemed preternatural. As always, Harry gave Snowman a chance to pause and survey the crowd, a gesture that made the crowd clap and stomp in appreciation. Maybe it was the horse's story that had drawn them in, or maybe it was seeing the young man get up from his dreadful fall, but Harry felt that the crowd was behind him. Excited and nervous for the young Dutchman, they were ready to be swept along with him. Harry forced his mind to go blank as he turned into his horse. There was nothing. No sound, just the feeling of talking to Snowman without words and the sense that he was guiding him around the course with his thoughts alone. But, with just two fences remaining, Harry heard the hollow knock of a hoof hitting the pole, one half fault for a hind touch. Horse and man galloped toward the final fence. If they could clear the last fence with no faults, they'd still be in the running. Snowman sank back, then leapt upward, but Harry sensed, rather than felt, Snowman's rear foot knocking the pole from the fence. Two faults. A good round, but not good enough. Adolf Magavero took home the blue for Oak Ridge with the flashy mare First Chance. For the first time any of the DeLayers could remember, there was no new ribbon to pin up next to Snowman's stall. After a season of incredible consistency, Harry and Snowman could not seem to hit their form. Garden magic. Unevenly distributed. Hard to get a hold of. Unpredictable. And sometimes cruel. Year after year, horses brought strings of successes to the garden, only to fail to be sprinkled with the magic. The garden had a way of forging new champions under the crucible of its spotlights. Right now, the magic was neglecting the small, out-of-the-way corner of the basement stables that was known as Hollandia Farms. The children looked crestfallen, but Harry tried to reassure them. It was a long show, and there'd be many more chances. He went about his barn tasks with the same degree of vigor as usual that night, not telling anyone of the places all over his back where the fall had left bruises. He spent an extra minute in Snowman's stall, whispering encouragement to the big gray. Okay, it was a slow start, but they weren't licked yet. Over the course of the show, there would be many more classes, culminating in the biggest challenge of all— the jumper stakes on the show's final night. The horse with the highest number of cumulative points by the end of the show would be champion. The next day, suddenly, Snowman hit his stride. He flew around the course with an effortless clean round, securing a spot in the jump-off against First Chance. First Chance's rider, Adolf Mogavero, a former jockey and steeplechase rider, had been winning on the show circuit for 10 years. Mogavero knew the ins and outs of garden courses, and he was coaxing outstanding performances from the mare. But Harry felt good about Snowman. First Chance had an advantage. Only 7 years old, she had spent her entire life as a pampered show horse. Snowman looked like a grizzled veteran in comparison, even though this was the older horse's first outing at the National. Mogavero and Harry waited side by side in the narrow alley adjacent to the inn gate. Behind the big white gate, the crew was raising the jumps. First Chance would be up first. From their vantage point at the inn gate, neither rider could see the fences. As the inn gate swung open, bringing with it the musty smell of the dirt surface of the ring, Harry caught a glance of the shortened, raised course of the jump-off. The gate man ushered Mogavero and First Chance into the ring, then closed the gate behind them. Harry could not watch Mogavero's ride, but he followed the progress from the sounds, the galloping strides, the brief moment of silence over the fences, the applause that followed each clean fence. A moment later, the gate swung open again. First Chance had put in a clean round. It was Snowman's turn. Harry turned to acknowledge the crowd, allowing his horse to do the same, then got down to business. He steadied Snowman on the approach to the first fence. After that, he dissolved into the teamwork of a ride that is working well. His body became his horse's body. His soul became his horse's soul. In a flash, the round was over. Snowman was clean. Another round of fence raising for a second jump off. The crowd exploded in applause. The crew raised the jumps again, and Harry and Adolf Mogavero waited in the wings. The two horses and riders could not have looked more different. First Chance, naturally high-strung and now more keyed up than ever, jigged in place, then paced in the narrow space. Snowman stood on a loose rein, one leg cocked in a horse's typical resting pose, his ears relaxed to the sides. Harry held the rein on the buckle and waited. When the gate swung open, First Chance bolted into the ring, leaving a small eddy of wind behind her. Again, Harry listened. This time, he heard the wooden thump of a pole hitting the ground, followed by a small groan from the crowd. The gate swung open, and Adolf nodded with a friendly camaraderie. Harry had an opening. A clean round would bring them the blue ribbon. How many clean rounds had Snowman put in over the last few months? Too many to count. But this was the garden, not a time to count on anything. As Harry trotted Snowman into the arena, and as the horse turned to look at the stands, the crowd erupted in applause. But this was no time to pay attention to the sights and sounds. Horse and rider had to muster every ounce of concentration, every bit of training and skill, courage and heart. 12 challenging fences, 12 chances to fault. From something as simple as a hoof rubbing against an obstacle to something as catastrophic as a crashing fall. In the high-stakes garden classes, horses faced the highest fences late at night when they were tired and frazzled and would normally be home in their stalls. More than once, a challenging late-night jump-off had pushed a horse past his limit. The jump crew, dressed in khakis, dark shirts, and driver's caps, clustered in the center of the ring. The ringmaster and the judge stood by, ready to take note of any mistake. Back in St. James, by this time of night, Snowman would be hanging his head over his stall door, his belly full of hay, looking at the stars in the dark countryside sky. Instead, the gray horse was about to face a difficult and highly demanding challenge. Harry gathered up the reins, squeezed his horse around the barrel with his calves, and whispered a word of encouragement. Now or never. Snowman stretched his neck out and bounded toward the fences with an evident joy. Up in the stands, the crowd went with him as he soared over each fence, unbound from gravity, unbound from his past and from the plow that had once weighed him down. 12 times he flew, clearing the fences with room to spare. 12 perfect fences, no faults. For the first time, the blue ribbon at the National Horse Show belonged to the big gray gelding, the lesson horse from the Knox School. Returning to the center of the ring to receive his prize, Snowman ambled along behind Harry, seemingly unaware of the ruckus that surrounded his victory. Up in the stands, thousands of people, families with children, shopkeepers, police officers, and secretaries, looked down from their perch high up in heaven, clapping wildly and uproariously cheering, smitten by the horse who seemed to fly without wings and yet was so firmly anchored to the ground. This horse knew how to steal hearts. That he had already stolen the heart of the handsome young man who rode him was apparent for all to see. Harry led the horse around the arena for a victory lap. The affection between the two could not be missed. That night, the Delayers hung a blue ribbon next to their horse's stall, and for the first time, a little bit of garden magic settled over their corner of the stables. But the show was hardly over. The open jumper competition was not one contest, but a series of contests. Each day brought a new series of grueling jump-offs and tiring courses. The opportunities for mistakes were everywhere. The courses demanded that the horses perform flawlessly, time after time. The following day, First Chance pulled ahead again, beating out Snowman. The two horses were neck and neck for the championship. Up in heaven, under blue clouds of cigarette smoke, munching on hot dogs doused in mustard, the ordinary folk held their breath, spellbound, every time Harry trotted into the ring. Harry smiled and waved to them after each clean round, raising his eyes up above the boxes to take in the entire crowd, and Snowman always followed suit. The competition was fierce. Every horse in the show had talent, but stamina would win in the end. For Harry, the week passed in a blur. Caring for the horses and keeping them in show shape in the cramped basement of the garden was almost a round-the-clock affair. The jumper classes sometimes did not start until 10 p.m. The jump-offs could stretch until 1 or 2 in the morning. After each class, Harry had to get the horses hot-walked and rubbed down, fed and groomed, and then the routine started up again in the pre-dawn hours. The world outside the garden receded, and the smoky, dusty, cramped confines of the basement stables became the world. One competitor referred to the week at the garden as being akin to life aboard ship on a long cruise. But by 1958, the cruise that the garden represented was like the voyage of the Titanic, a final gasp of a privileged way of life. The jubilant, chaotic, disorganized, private spectacle of the rich at play would soon start on a course of changes that would come to seem inevitable, and as ordinary folk crossed paths with society swells on their way through the turnstiles, it was a giddy, marvelously unsettling moment in time. The show that had begun with the Cuban protesters bringing the world stage to what had once been a parochial affair was ending with a big dose of garden magic. And, like an 8-day cruise, the week that at first had seemed as if it would last forever was suddenly drawing to a close. The show's last day would feature the open jumper stakes. There were 3 legs to the horse show Triple Crown: the American Horse Show's Association Horse of the Year, the Professional Horsemen's Association Championship, and the National Horse Show Championship. The Horse of the Year and PHA honors were decided on points accumulated throughout the season, and Snowman had already earned enough points to secure those 2 prizes. Going into the last night of the National, the final leg of the Triple Crown was at stake. If Snowman won the class, he would make a clean sweep, winning show jumping's top 3 honors. The last class of the show involved 2 rounds over an identical course, 1 in the afternoon of the show's last day and 1 that night. Points for the 2 rounds would be added together to decide the champion. The only horses still in contention for show champion were Snowman and First Chance. Going into this final class, First Chance had a 1-point lead.